I'm DeMelo Roberts, stage and studio on Arts Watch. Most artists and arts organizations in Oregon know her name. She is the former co-owner of a world-class winery. She used to be a high school teacher in Massachusetts until 1983. And before that, she was the youngest French language professor at Suffolk University until they decided to fire all the female faculty, a practice that was unfortunately legal then. She studied Romance languages and literature and has degrees from Cornell University, the University of Michigan, and the Paris Sorbonne University. And since the early 2000s, she has been one of the most recognizable, most accessible, and generous patron and donor to the arts in Oregon. Everyone who attends performing arts events, art exhibits, films, music festivals, they know her name. She's personal in her giving and support, and a model philanthropist who also mentors and advises on the arts. And she's just as busy as ever helping to sustain and shape the arts from her modest home in McMinnville. Arts Watch has benefited from her generosity through the years, and so have I, through my nonprofit, Meteorites. I've had numerous phone conversations and in-person meetings with my next guest. For her, it's all about building relationships. Quite often, these conversations are just two friends enjoying each other's company. Here's an example.
Well, okay.
I had the joy of talking to geese today, so we'll end the phone call. I'll honk a little bit, okay?
What does your goose sound like?
So there were about 40 of them down there, and they were all going, honk, 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 honk.
That's a really good goose. Do you want to hear my chicken? Because I grew up with chickens. It's like,
sounds like my neighbor's chicken. It's perfect. I talked to ducks.
Okay, what did they sound like? That's good. That's really good. Okay.
If you haven't guessed who I'm talking about yet, well, here's the reveal. It's my pleasure to welcome Ronnie S. LaCroute on stage and studio on Arts Watch. Hey, Ronnie.
Dime.
I believe this is the very first time you've ever been on stage and studio.
That's true. I haven't been on it before, and I'm delighted now.
Well, I want to thank you for being my most loyal listener through the years, because it always warmed my heart whenever, you know, I posted audio and you go, that was a great interview. And I go, oh, thank you, Ronnie.
I think I've listened to every show.
I think you have. And it does. It really means a lot to me. So we've had talks in the past about your philosophy of giving and why philanthropy is important to you. Would you tell our audience just your philosophy about giving?
It's pretty straightforward. I feel called to help make the world a better place so people have opportunities. And I give in areas, very widespread areas, that all have one goal in mind, which is to make the world a better place. I support the arts, but the arts with social impact. I support social services, humanitarian work, with the idea of helping folks and, you know, have a good life.
I mean, you know, you say it's simple, but there's so much involved in that. You spend a lot of time. Would you tell me, like, what your normal day is regarding thinking about giving?
Well, I mean, it's a full-time occupation at this point.
I believe you.
Yeah, I talk to people on the phone. I meet people in person, mostly outdoors these days. I answer emails, and I'm constantly setting up meetings so I can talk about people's projects and activities. And it's all based on personal relationships. And my trust in what folks are doing to achieve the goals that we've set.
Well, you really believe in human infrastructure when deciding on funding the arts. It's the person associated with the project or organization. It's about the person or the people.
It's completely about the person. Absolutely. Which is why I have to set up meetings, because those relationships are how I make my decisions. If I trust that the person has good intentions plus the ability to do what they say they're going to do, I can make a decision clearly. Whereas if I read something on a piece of paper, I don't know what that means. It's all based on pretty much face-to-face ear to ear and my voice to your voice type of relationships.
And about trust as well, I would think.
Of course it's about trust. Yes. But rarely do people come to me who disappoint me, because I think I pretty much don't set up meetings with the kinds of folks who don't mean what they say.
I believe you've talked about to me personally about your mom's influence as well, you know, or your parents' influence on your idea of being a benefactor and a lover of the arts. Would you say that early upbringing really melded that?
Well, I credit my mother with everything that I do, actually. She was my role model. My mother was a very giving person. The arts were critically important, as were social services and social justice. And she didn't have a lot to give, but she gave what she had. And she took me to theater. She took me to music. She trained me in the importance of the arts in forming a well-rounded person. And I'm just following her model.
Well, I want to ask you also about your teen years, because you were quoted in a Portland Monthly piece about how you felt like you were living in a spy novel. You want to elaborate on that?
My father took a job that sent the whole family to Poland in 1961. We lived in Warsaw. Well, that was the height of the Cold War. Hey, I was a teenager, right? So I thought it was absolutely fabulous. The opportunities to interact with spies and with people who, you know, were the KGB and all of that. So I found the bugs in my bedroom. I found car, and I would broadcast to them every evening. So you could expect from me something like, "Good evening, gentlemen of the KGB. Here's the news of the day." And I would feed them disinformation. And I just had a blast. Fortunately, nothing bad happened to my family as a result. But it could have. I didn't realize the risks I was taking.
Yeah, you were a kid, but that makes for a funny story, though. Not many people, at least in America, maybe now people think that the NSA is listening to our phone conversations, but to have that as a daily experience of having to look for bugs in your, you know, listening devices in your room, that's unusual.
Well, actually, if we wanted to say anything meaningful, my brother and I went outdoors to a big field. Otherwise, we were told, you know, never say anything in the house about any of our plans, what we were doing, or, you know, who we were seeing or anything.
Wow. So it rings true. If you want to go someplace, you know, you leave the water running in the bathroom and then you can have phone conversations or something, right? I mean, it's interesting, though, shifting forward, you know, to all your education and your love of the arts. What are some of the, in your early years, the most memorable arts performances that kind of shaped you when you were growing up?
I was very lucky, because when we lived in the area of Washington, D.C., we had the National Theater and Arena stage producing fantastic shows. And my mother subscribed to both of them and took me. My brother didn't really have any interest, but I did. So I think I went to every show for a number of years at both of those theaters. And I especially remember Arena Stage. I remember seeing Chekhov's plays there. And I was in awe of the skills of the director, the actors. It turned me on to that. And when I got to Europe, I was sent to school at an international school with a strong theater program. So in Geneva, Switzerland, I had the opportunity to act in a production of Hedda Gabler, again at the age of, I guess I was 17 at that point. And Yul Brynner's son, Rocky, was in that show. And Yul was in the audience watching us on stage.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing, by the way. I had a minor role. I was not Hedda Gabler. I was the maid. But still, just being in that show, I learned so much.
Were you gravitating more towards theater and music when you were studying the arts?
I was actually more interested in chemistry, but I never let go of the arts. I spent a lot of my time reading chemistry books and doing math problems for fun. I happened to adore calculus. And when I went on to university, I thought I was going to major in chemistry. But little by little, things changed. And I ended up a French major. And of course, there was a lot of art that went along with that. So I studied, you know, the history of the visual arts, music, and theater in France as part of my studies.
I'm wondering too, you know, we're going to shift forward to your time before the pandemic, when you retired, sort of. You're not really retired, because you're busier than ever.
But in the 2000s and attending more and more, you know, Portland theater, more local theater, Oregon events and performances and arts venues, I'm wondering what made you continue to gravitate toward the arts? What draws you?
Oh, my goodness. What draws me is the human factor. The emotions that the arts evoke, I find very important to me as a human being. That I just, the other day I went to a show and I just realized what it did for my heart. And I just came out of it feeling sort of a tenderness towards the story that I had heard. I think that it's really important for everybody to find a place where they can connect with their own emotions. And I find that in all of the arts.
And that was Loch Lomond that you went to at Broadway Rose?
That was Loch Lomond, a production at Broadway Rose. It's a new play, and it's just beautiful to see musical theater again. Just, oh, such an emotional experience.
Well, it's almost like you're a family member, because you are one of the most ardent attenders of arts events. And it always warmed my heart. You know, even if I can clearly tell that you didn't like something, I just love that you were there, you know? And it was like a family member coming to see this. And you have that kind of personal relationship. And I'm wondering how much you absolutely missed it during the pandemic. What was that like for you to not attend?
Well, I felt very cut off from my arts family. We talked by telephone a lot, but it's just not the same. Every time I saw people on the screen in a filmed production, I was realizing how much I missed being in the same room. You can't hug the person on the screen. I was missing the hugs.
I remember you came to, it was the last production that probably you and I both attended, which is the Journal of Ben Uchida at Oregon Children's Theater, which I directed. And we only had a 2-week run and then everything shut down. But I remember, you know, you came back afterwards into the lobby and we were doing the elbow shake as opposed to the hug, right? And it was just interesting how that shifted so quickly.
I really missed that. And now we're not quite back to the full hugs again, but just being in the room is a gift.
I know that you've been attending some things, but what are some of the considerations that you have to make for yourself as an audience member to be able to attend? Because we're not out of the pandemic yet. There's the Delta variant. And I just read something that the vaccine may start wearing out, you know? And so what makes you feel safe enough? And I think this is, you know, for all, like you're representing all audience members, because I don't quite myself feel safe. And there have to be a certain set of circumstances for me to attend. But what are your circumstances?
Okay, now I'm a senior citizen. I've had various illnesses in the past. I have vulnerabilities. So I am very careful. And my considerations are, is this a place where everybody is going to be masked? Are we spaced out enough that we aren't able to spread the disease as quickly in case somebody in the room is ill? And it's possible. As we know, the vaccine does not prevent contracting the illness, so we can't depend on vaccination status to do everything for us. So I'm looking for multiple things, you know, the space, the vaccine, the mask, all of it together. Are we doing as much as we can? So I avoid small spaces where we can't, you know, sit a little bit far from people, or places where people just really aren't following guidelines. So I can't attend in person all the things I would like to, and I'm very selective. So I haven't seen that much in person and still watching some things remotely. I don't drive as far as I used to. So, you know, the senior citizen, I just have to be careful.
Well, and I'm still astounded at how many times you used to take a 3-hour trip to Portland, right, there and back again, and attend maybe even a couple of things before you went home. I mean, and you did this a couple times a week, maybe 3 or 4 sometimes. And I was always astounded at how your commitment to that.
Well, I was very committed and I did it. But as I get older, I realize I can't keep doing that, especially now when I have to keep my immune system primed, right?
So yeah, I'll be doing that less. But what I appreciate is that people are helping me out. And like, I had a ride to Broadway Rose with Sharon Maroney herself, who founded the company, right?
And I think you'll find more and more people are willing to do that because it is important for you to be able to be part of this community, you know, because you are a part of it. And so, like I said, it's a family member. you got to get a ride, right? So you are still very busy every day fielding questions and conversations, sometimes in person, but more on the phone, as you said, from people who are seeking sponsorship or funding from you. What's your advice to people you work with and who are seeking that?
First, my advice is to do something truly meaningful and important, and then have a conversation with me about the impact of the project. And if it's something that really we believe in, and I'm saying we because this is a partnership, then it's something that I feel I want to invest in. It's a little different from grant funding, where there are specific guidelines for each grant. This is a one-by-one decision. I mean, I look at one thing at a time and see if it speaks to me. And if the people making it are passionate about it also and believe it will be, you know, transformative, you know, it's a different way of going about funding, really.
And this is going to be maybe difficult, but what's the hardest no's or the hardest no you've ever had to say? Because you don't fund everybody.
I'm one person. I can't fund everybody because I'm simply one person. So I have to decide. And I've said no to a number of projects that are perfectly worthy. There are various reasons I would say no. It's hard to describe each reason. Sometimes it's because I believe the project will find enough other funders. And I know there's some people who can only find funding with me. Sometimes it just doesn't speak to me. It's not something that I relate to, or I don't feel like it has the impact I'd like to see. Each decision is made singly, right?
And even though you say no, oftentimes you will give advice.
Oh, correct. Usually, in fact, if I'm going to say no, I do have some further advice, either how the person can find funding for the existing project elsewhere, or what can be done to make the project more impactful so it's more likely to get funding either with me or somebody else.
That's good. That's good. Because, you know, because that's part of it, too. I mean, a grants officer will also do that. I don't think people realize that. But sometimes people get so upset, they just don't follow through. And that's part of the learning process.
Yeah, and I think most funders want to see projects be successful. We don't want to turn down artists and have them, you know, stop making art. So yeah, definitely try to seek out advice. If your project is rejected, find out why and how you can pursue it maybe in a slightly different way.
But I would think that since you're a person and you are a person who is accessible, like you do talk with people. And, you know, I would think that some people who might be more naive, perhaps, or inexperienced might say, well, this would be a good way for me to get a new car or something. You know, I mean, I don't want to think that about a lot of folks, but sometimes it's like, oh, well, you know, maybe, you know, I don't have to get a job if I can get Ronnie's support. So
no, it has never worked like that, because usually I'm involved with the project itself enough, you know, that I know that it didn't go to a new car. Because the project ate up all the funds, you know, and there was nothing left for the new car. I'm sorry.
The secret to that is that you don't get funded again, you know, if you do something like that, you know.
I also want to see the project. So, and almost every time I'm involved to some extent along the way, you know, at various the milestones in the development of the project. So I know it's where it's going.
Well, you know, I know I'm just using it as a worst case example, but you know, I mean, sometimes people can be a little lame. So I also know that you often give larger organizations and institutions on a yearly basis. I mean, were there times that you had to pull that funding?
No, not yet, because I'm not giving to organizations that have, how should I say, failed in their mission. No, I pretty much stick with the organizations that I back.
So for most people, though, who have the means to be a donor, to be a funder, a sponsor, what's your best pitch for them to become donors?
I would say if you want to see the world become a
better place. If you want to see healing in this, in society, if you want to support your community, one of the best ways is through the arts. We can't leave that out. And yes, there are many organizations and nonprofits that need support, but the arts are an integral part of the health of the community. So I would call on all major donors to consider arts donations as well as other donations.
Well, and I'm wondering too, you have so much insider information, you know, about a lot of arts organizations, about artists, and because you have these personal conversations. I'm wondering, how do you think the pandemic is going to shape the future of the arts?
Okay, the pandemic has brought out more inequities than we ever saw before and made them really clear to people. And so I think going forward, the arts will evolve, first of all, to be more equitable because we saw inequities within arts communities, and also to tell the stories that weren't being told before. I think we're going to hear other voices. There have been a lot of changes during the pandemic, and there'll be even more going forward, definitely.
I agree with you because I think there has been a lot of shakeups regarding diversity, inclusion, and equity, and just in the infrastructure too, which is very important.
Well, as the content of the arts. I think we're finding out that there were a lot of inequities in the infrastructure of the arts, as well as the content of arts programming. And after the pandemic calms down a little bit, I think we're going to move forward in very different ways than we did before.
I think a lot of organizations are going to stick to that, but I think there will also be organizations that will try to wait it out and then go back to doing what they did before.
That can't work, Dima. That can't work going forward. I think we're finally seeing different leadership, and that's going to change everything. Much more equitable leadership, where you don't have to be an old white male to rise to the leadership position. That, I don't think we're going backwards on that.
Well, let's hope so. You know, because, you know, people do try to get away with what they can.
We've learned a lot, and I don't think young people are going to let that happen either.
I agree with you there. I do agree with you.
And I don't think people will accept going back to the old ways of doing business. You know, they want change. They're becoming very active politically. They're going to hold us to a few things that were promised during the pandemic.
And they're very vocal about calling stuff out.
Exactly.
Yeah, I do appreciate that. It's often painful for a lot of people to change, but change is good.
Hey, everything comes at a cost, you know? Of course it's painful.
Yeah, that's called growing up. It's called growing. Yeah, because we never stop, or we shouldn't. You know, we're all growing all the time. Any other final shout outs for Arts Watch or Stage and Studio or arts organizations?
We need also to support arts journalism. Speaking about, yes, all the things that you do with Stage and Studio and Arts Watch, we need that more than ever so that we talk about the arts and learn what's going on and spread the word and get more support for the arts. We need high quality arts journalism. So let's support that too.
Well, I think we appreciate that, Ronnie. We really do. I know that Arts Watch is very appreciative. I know that Media Rights too, my organization, is very appreciative as well. You're a shining light, you know, in your support of the arts. And I hope that you feel appreciated because you are an important person. And I really appreciate you. We've gone through so much to get this interview today. So I appreciate the time that you spent trying to get this interview together with massive technology problems, right?
Yeah.
You know, I do want to ask you, you were a French language professor at Suffolk, right? University. Why were all the female faculty fired?
Our department chair, this was just the department, was misogynist openly, and he could get away with it because there was no law against it in the early 70s, because it was, all of this was the first half of the 70s, right? Okay, and he made no bones about it. He would always criticize the females. He said, oh, they're emotional. They, you know, the older woman in the department was going through menopause, and he'd tell terrible stories about menopause, talked about our bodies. He talked about, you know, various organs and openly. It was horrible.
he made it really clear that the guys were serious professors and that the women really just didn't count. Well, as it turns out, all the good teaching was happening in the women's classrooms, not in the men's classrooms. And the students knew it. And so the guys compensated by mistreating the women.
Yeah, I don't think people, you know, newer generations don't realize. I mean, I entered the workplace after Title IX. And I don't think people realize how important that legislation was.
Critical. Oh, my gosh. It was just misery before that. And also, the year I was laid off, it was right after I'd given birth. And so it was, you know, there was that rule. If you get pregnant, you're gone. And I not only got pregnant, I gave birth. You know, I mean, she has a baby. She can't teach. So then I went to high school teaching where it was totally acceptable to have a family. Because most high school teachers, frankly, were women with families.
Yeah, yeah.
It was much more a welcoming environment. And in fact, I wondered why I'd ever gone into college teaching because it was so unwelcoming.
There's no such thing as good old days.
It was very difficult back then. And yeah, young people now don't realize how horrid it was.
Wow, yeah. So all those experiences make Ronnie LaCrude. So Ronnie, keep listening to the animals around you because I do want to hear some new animal impressions next time.
I'll work on that, DMA.
Thank you, Ronnie, for taking the time today. Ronnie S. LaCrude, thank you so much for this conversation today. That's it for Stage and Studio on Arts Watch this week. You can always catch the show on stageandstudio.org and ArtsWatch at orartswatch.org. And subscribe on any podcast platform and like us on facebook.com/stage-the-letter-n-studio. Till our next conversation, I'm DMA Lowe Roberts.